with the practical information you need for personal and spiritual growth, this is the Word Audio How-To Library. What makes men different, and why? How can the conflict be resolved between a woman's expectations and the reality that she experiences? That's what this How-To Library tape is all about, as Dr. Norman Wright tells how to understand the man in your life. The information he shares, based on his book of the same title, will help women sort out their opinions and feelings about men. Dr. Wright is a marriage counselor and professor of counseling at Talbot Seminary. He is founder and director of Christian Marriage Enrichment and Family Counseling and Enrichment in Santa Ana, California. Dr. Wright is joined for this presentation by his friend Jan Congo, who is a lecturer, seminar leader, and author, and wife of one of the counselors at Dr. Wright's Counseling Center. We begin this presentation with Dr. Wright's response to a question from Jan about his description in the book of Jesus as the total man, and how that his masculinity was not stereotypical with contemporary views of manhood.
I think one of the main differences there is that as you look at the life of Christ, you're able to see the fact that he experienced and expressed deep emotions. And that's something that is a bit foreign to most men in our American society as such. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, there's a difference between the way in which men and women are structured in terms of their brain. A woman's brain, they use it holistically, where the left and the right side are functioning at the same time because of thousands of additional nerve connectors between the two sides. Men have to shift back and forth from the right side to the left side. And women are more in tune emotionally. They have a sense of intuition because of the way in which they're created. And then secondly, in our culture, women are encouraged to be expressive, to be in touch with their feelings, to really emote, as it were. The view of masculinity in our society is that a man is strong, in control, and does not show weakness by expressing emotions, which is unfortunate because it is not a sign of weakness to experience and express those emotions. It's a sign of real strength. I've gone through that whole struggle myself because in the early years of marriage, I did not share my insecurities, my fears, my doubts. I wanted to appear strong, maybe for myself as much as for other people. And then because of having a profoundly retarded child come into our family, all the barriers and the obstacles to those emotions were just ripped and torn away. And so I had no option but to begin to really feel. And I know what was threatening about this is that often I would feel out of control the hurt or the pain of the loss of knowing what it was like to be the father of a son would come about every now and then. And, you know, there was just no way of controlling the feelings that would come out. And I would weep, and then I would come back in control. But I always felt so much better, almost like a refreshment, after I had really let loose with these emotions. And then eventually over the years, I could talk about the emotion instead of just express it. I could put it into words. And this is something that most men have to learn to do. We have not been raised with a what I would call an emotional or feeling vocabulary. Men that I work with that I'm trying to encourage to open up and talk with their spouse, many of them in frustration will cry out and say, I guess I would like to, but I don't even know how to define what right. I am feeling. And secondly, where are the words? Mm-hmm. So I put them into a synonym finder. I give them a list of feeling words, and I have them practice these words out loud. And this is one of the ways that a wife or a woman can help the man in her life by continuing to use emotional or feeling vocabulary, by even reflecting that, you know, it might even be difficult for you to put into words your feelings, but do the best that you can, and I'm willing to accept whatever you can share with me, and I'm certainly not going to criticize you for your attempt. And when you're comfortable in doing that, let me know.
I like that second part. I'm not going to criticize you for your attempt. Over and over in the book, you stress that if a husband gets the feeling words out there, the worst thing for a woman to do is to condemn him for it, condemn those emotions or criticize those emotions or do anything but cherish what has come out.
That's right. Even if it's a very, what I would call, ineffectual approach, mm-hmm. it's his first attempt, and we cannot expect perfection from somebody who maybe for 35 or 40 years has never really moved into this whole new country of emotions. It's a very initial type of a beginning for him. And if there is any hint of criticism, whether it be through word or gesture or nonverbal expression on the face, he will clam up so tight it'll be years before he's willing to reach out again.
Are there other things the wife can do to help her husband bring those feelings to the surface?
Well, just the encouragement and letting him know that whenever he is willing to share them, she's willing to listen. In fact, I know of some wives who have approached their husbands by saying, I realize that it's sometimes difficult for you to talk with me about emotions, and there's something I wanted to bring up, and right now probably isn't the best time, and when you feel comfortable, let me know. And then they've left the room, and within 5 or 10 minutes, the husband is there saying, well, wait a minute, I think I can handle whatever you're going to say.
I love that. I love that illustration. And the wife also who made a date, she says, oh, well, let's discuss it over dinner the next evening.
That's
or
right.
Something. And you said, do the unexpected. I thought, oh, yay for that woman. That
and not
is
demand.
Fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Because men resist not only demands, men tend to resist even good quality suggestions because it's not their idea. And unfortunately, many married couples get into what I call a power struggle where they interpret a request as a demand,
right,
and they back off, and yet it's something that would have benefited them to begin with.
Does the man's relationship with his father tie into this inability to express feelings?
It certainly can, because the role model that a man has is quite important. If he sees a man who, or sees a father who is very demonstrative, not only in behavior, but verbally, and uses feeling words and encourages the boy to express himself and draws him out and doesn't belittle him, then that boy, as he becomes a man, is going to feel very comfortable about expressing himself emotionally, and is also going to be willing to go against the tide, as it were, with other men. It's really important that parents look at how they're responding to their daughters and to their sons, because they could be putting them into this role or this box that we've had created for us within our society.
For years.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it crucially important for men to develop close friendships? Norm, I found this a very fascinating part of your book.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why men tend to be brittle. They don't bend. And it's because they try to handle the issues of life by themselves. They don't share it. We know that as people go through different types of crisis, that the ones who survive the crisis the best are those who have walked through that time with another individual, with a close friend. But men have, I guess I call it acquaintances rather than close friends. And part of the reason for that is the fear that somebody else is going to get the upper hand. There's this real competitive dynamic or edge that's involved in the life of so many men. And so when they share with somebody else, they want to talk about how they're doing. They talk about numbers. They want to prove to the other person that they're quite capable. But in a real friendship, you're willing to be vulnerable, to open up and to share your joys, your hurts, your sorrows, your delights. And I would say, yeah, I'm just trying to remember a time when I was lacking close male friends. And I guess there was a period of time from about in my 20s to mid-30s, and then I felt the need more and more and have developed several close friendships. I have about 4 or 5 men that I feel so comfortable with that I can talk over anything with them. I can share my emotions, my hurts, my joys, my struggles. I can cry with them, and I'm not embarrassed about it. I rely on these people, and they rely on me. There's that interchange, and I realize that I don't have to go through my life by myself. And I think it's a tragedy when I see so many men who are trying to carry that burden and that load all by themselves, because I know when they get to the time of retirement, they are going to feel so isolated, since the only other person that they probably have any kind of close contact with is their wife, and it's probably not that close. And with men like this, if their wife happens to die before they do, usually within a year or two, they end up dying because of loneliness, despair. There's no more meaning in their life. And I really encourage the men that I work with in seminars and in counseling to begin reaching out and establishing contact. I had a man this last year who heard me speak at a conference, and he came in 3 months later and he said, Norm, I've been bothered ever since you spoke, because you said that it's not healthy for us to go through life without close male friendships, and I have no close friends, and I want to know, why isn't this healthy for me? I don't feel the need of them. Well, as we worked together in counseling, he began to see more and more how he did need somebody else. And one additional factor, we hear a lot today about the male midlife crisis.
I was going to bring that up because that just stood out to me, that if he wants to survive,
he's got to have friends.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I want the listeners to realize is that all men do not go through a male midlife crisis. Unfortunately, I think there's some materials out that give that impression that every man is going to go through this full-blown male midlife crisis where he changes his values radically. He buys a sports car, he runs off with the secretary, and on and on. About a third of the men go through the crisis. The rest of us go through a normal midlife transition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important for women to realize that in the 40s, when men are reevaluating what's important, going through a value change, when a man mentions something that's quite off the wall or different, like, you know, I wonder what it would be like to just quit this job and get another type of job that didn't have the pressures, and maybe move to a small town, that's a time to listen and draw him out and not say, what do you mean quit your job? We can't afford to.
Not freak
We've got to stay
out,
here
right?
and just
yeah.
go off the wall.
Right.
And I've gone through transitions. About every 7 years, I will take a change in terms of the direction of my work or ministry because I've been fulfilled and I need a new challenge. And for some time, I was a bit concerned what was wrong with me because I was going through this value change. I was comparing myself with other people who stayed in the same job 20, 30, 40 years, mm-hmm. were totally satisfied, and it wasn't until I read the book, The Seasons of a Man's Life by Levinson, that I realized that I was normal, and I happened to be one of the individuals that would go with the change and try to create something different. But when we go back to these men now who are having the midlife crisis, they are fairly predictable, and there are three major characteristics. One is, these are the men whose main or only source of identity is their work or their job. These are men who have never learned to share their emotions and their feelings. The feelings are there inside, but they're churning around and they don't know what to do with them. And thirdly, these are the men who do not have close male friendships. Whenever I see a man who fits that category, it doesn't mean that he is going to have the midlife crisis where everything goes into an upheaval state, but he is the one who is most prone for that to occur.
Since we're talking about midlife crisis, what if my husband's going through it? What if he's right in the midst of it? What can I as a woman do to assist him through this time besides not freaking out?
Oh, that's a very rough situation because I've worked with a number of women whose husbands are in the what I call the real midlife crisis. And one of the things that you have to have is an abundance of patience, because you would hope that the man would, quote, come to his senses as soon as possible. And there's no way to predict how long this is going to take. I think it's important for a woman to listen to the man, to reflect his feelings, to encourage him to talk them out, to maybe encourage him to talk to other men that have gone through this experience, but encourage him in such a way that here's something you might want to do or you might not want to do. It's totally up to you.
No forcing.
No forcing, no demanding, no saying you ought.
Right.
You should. Nothing like that.
One thing I really valued in this book was that you keep stressing to women that they need very much to keep developing themselves.
That's right.
So that they are interesting people and they're not getting all of their feeding out of that relationship with their husband. But they're bringing back a very rich woman into the relationship.
The way you're saying it, Jan, almost sounds like a dependency type of a relationship. And in a marriage, whenever there is a dependency relationship, the marriage is kind of fragile, because if one person starts to change that balance from being the controller or the dependent person, then the whole marriage is rocking and sometimes just falls apart. And unfortunately, many women today are putting all their hopes and their dreams into the man, into what he thinks, what he believes, his success, his involvement at work, and they've not had an opportunity to really develop their own identity.
Right. It's as if he's an extension of them.
That's right. And when he falls apart, then what happens? But on the other hand, you have to realize that if the man is falling apart and the woman is strong, he will begin to see that strength as part of his enemy. Because when a man is in a midlife crisis, everything becomes the enemy. His wife, his children, the job, church, God, everyone is against him. It's almost like a slight case of paranoia that can develop at times.
Right.
And it's so unfortunate. And there are many men who weather this storm and come out of it, but they will be coming out of it different than they were before. Now, one of the things for our listeners to realize is that basically the vast majority of men in their 40s begin to become interested in the whole area of feelings and intimacy. They've been so much on this identity kick all their life and building their identity in their job, they now come to the place where they're thinking, you know, there's got to be more to life than this.
And this is about the time she packs up her briefcase.
That's right.
And walks out the door and says, you know, I've had all this feeling and intimacy, and I've raised these children, and I've been your wife. Now I want to find out how exciting it is out there.
That's right. It's a classic role reversal. And what we're saying, though, is it doesn't have to happen. If couples who are in their 20s and their 30s begin dealing with these issues of identity and intimacy and feelings at this time, it's a great preventative against some of these major crises happening later on in the 40s. What I'm talking about are the developmental type of crises, like the male midlife crisis, as well as some of the others that occur.
Interesting, interesting. All right, now, you had a fascinating statement for me. You said that anger is a symptom. And you talked about how men will show anger when they show feelings, but that very often the wife can get fooled by that anger. Now, what is underlying the anger, and how do men hide their feelings?
Well, I'm glad you brought that one up, because anger seems to be sort of a, I guess you'd call it a masculine emotion. If I hate to classify it in that way, but that's the one that men feel very comfortable in just expressing and cutting loose and yelling and
that's
getting excited.
That's the cowboy.
That's right. It's the cowboy image.
Yeah, right.
And they can jump up and down. But you notice it's not showing necessarily compassion or tenderness, the emotions which they might equate with women.
It's almost a competitive emotion.
It definitely
because
is.
You can I can't say the word, can I? Annihilate the person you're angry at without ever facing the issue.
You can keep a person at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And if a man does not want somebody to get close to them, this is the great defense to get angry. But anger is what I call a secondary emotion. It is not what is really going on. And at the basis or the heart of anger in both men and women, you will usually find one of three things: fear, hurt, or frustration. And if there's frustration, it usually means that there are some unfulfilled expectations or needs that are there. But unfortunately, the individual involved probably didn't say, here's my expectation or here is my need. So in a relationship between a man and a woman, if a woman can respond to what's underlying the anger and not be intimidated by it, not allow it to dominate or control her, but just to keep talking calmly, and maybe even reflect back to the man, boy, John, I can really sense your frustration right now. Or, you know, John, I'm just wondering if you're really angry or if there's some hurt you're experiencing because of what our son has done. And what a woman is doing is extending an invitation to the man to express the other emotion that perhaps he might be a bit hesitant in expressing. And a man has to hear this as invitation. Invitation.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And if it can be said in that way, and something else I need to add here, and I'm sure this is going to open a whole can of worms, say it once and very briefly, and don't say it again. Because men are really resistant to hearing too many words. Men's style of speaking is short, to the point, what's the bottom line?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they want to hear.
I thought that your chapter on speaking one another's language was very, very helpful. You know, what can you say in a few minutes? I mean, this is just an enormous topic, but what can you say to help a woman to speak her her husband's language. She needs to be to the point. Yes, you have some very good suggestions in here.
Let me approach this in a very different way. Jan, if you and Dave had come to me for premarital counseling before you got married, probably during the first or the second session, I would have stopped everything, looked at the two of you, and made the statement, Jan, are you aware of the fact that when you marry Dave, you're marrying a foreigner?
At that point, I probably would have said, no. At this point, I say, yes.
You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
17 years does persuade you of that.
People marry foreigners in the sense that they bring to their marriage a different culture, a different style of language, a different framework of communication, even different meaning to words. One of the things I don't want to do is to stereotype men and women, because there are many different exceptions.
Right.
But generally speaking, women, when they talk, have a much richer vocabulary. They give a much richer description, and often with emotion or feeling words, they tend to use adjectives which give a greater amount of impact, where a man might say, this is fine. A woman would say, isn't that fantastic? Wasn't
right.
that wonderful?
Right.
Listen to the conversations of men and women, and you will really note the difference in their style. And so when men and women are talking, unfortunately, they often end up feeling like we were talking past one another. Mm-hmm. We weren't on the same wavelength. Mm-hmm. Well, women have such a rich vocabulary and want to get in as much detail as possible that often a man feels overwhelmed, because most men are oriented to what's the bottom line? What's the point of all this? And even if a woman likes to give a lot of peripheral information or side issues as she gives a description to another woman, if she can shift that and just straight out give the bottom line, just like the first line of a newspaper article on the front page of a paper, she will have the man's attention. I remember a few months ago I was speaking on this on a radio program, and we're talking about this whole subject of bottom line versus the amplification. And I got home, and my wife Joyce came up to me, put her arms around me, looked me in the eye, and said, good job, Norm, good job. That's the bottom line. And walked away, and I was dumbfounded.
Laughing.
And she just really, really nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other things that I want to mention, too, that even though I'm giving some suggestions here to probably mostly women who are listening to this tape, if I were talking to men, I would really encourage the man to begin to listen to his woman's vocabulary and style of speaking. And if he tends to be what I call a condenser, mm-hmm. and gives just two-line responses, or gives the word fine,
yes.
like so many of them do, go ahead and amplify. Give her a lot of rich information and a lot of detail, because the theme of this book is not that women have to be the ones to do all the adaptation and changing. We want men to consider changing and adapting to the woman in their life as well, because it's a two-way street. It's not just one person making those changes that are so necessary.
It certainly needs to be, or it's a real setup for
balance.
Yes.
It really is.
And it's a setup for a lot of things that we don't want to have happen
right.
in these marriages, that's for sure.
You know, one of the other suggestions that I would make to wives in particular is for them to ask their husband, number one, how do you want to be greeted at the end of the day when you get home? Do you want a lot of information? Do you want questions? Do you want just touching? Do you want some type of contact? What is the best way to greet you? And I think that will really set the tone for the evening, because what occurs between a couple during the first 4 minutes at the end of the day when they first see one another does set the atmospheric
sure
tone
does.
For the evening.
Right.
And then another question would be to ask the man, what is the best time in the evening to talk with you? After dinner, when the children are in bed, during a commercial, after your favorite program, which I know you really like to watch? And see, I'm trying to suggest that they put this in a positive perspective instead of a comment like, well, is that program over with yet?
Right.
You know, any kind of negative innuendo will cause a man to retreat. He will go deeper into his silence. And it will bring about the very thing that perhaps the woman doesn't want to have happen.
I hope, as women listen to this, they'll realize that when they use a recipe and it doesn't work, they throw out the recipe. But in life, when they use some kind of a style of relating to their man, they often, when it doesn't work, just use it again and again and louder and louder and over and over. And I just hope that they are hearing you, that there are different ways to approach things here.
You have nailed that so beautifully, Jan, because what people do is that if this isn't working to get the person to open up, I'll just intensify, and I'm going to try harder.
Right, I'll just
and the harder
wham
they try,
then
the worse
right,
it
the
gets.
The worse it is.
It's a vicious cycle.
You also mentioned simple little things, listening to your spouse and hearing if he says feeling words or hearing words or sight words. Can you amplify on that a little bit? Like,
okay, I think what you're talking about is the dominant sense that
yes.
a person has, because some of us are more visual. Some of us are more auditory. And some are more feeling-oriented. Men, generally speaking, again, because there are going to be all sorts of exceptions here, men tend to be visually oriented to life. They want to see things. It's the same way in the sexual relationship. They are attracted to the way in which a woman looks initially. Then they begin checking out to see if the woman is intelligent, the way in which she speaks, if she can carry on a good conversation, other capabilities and whatnot. The way in which you would learn this about a man is to listen to his vocabulary. If you hear a man making statements like, well, Jan, do you get the whole picture? Do you see what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Look at it this way, will you?
Mm-hmm.
You hear that type of terminology, the chances are quite good that visual is important to him.
Right.
Now, what this means is that when you talk with him, instead of saying, honey, how do you really feel about this?
Right.
Or did you get the sense of this? When you do that, you've lost him.
Yes, he just
you're not
doesn't
speaking
hear it.
His language.
Uh-huh.
But if you go to him and maybe put things in writing, honey, take a look at this. See what you think about this. You have a visual man. If you give him verbal reminders to do things around the house, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
You've lost it.
Mm-hmm.
He's the kind of a person that will probably respond best to having it in writing, having a reminder on his calendar. He's the kind that perhaps might like little notes tucked in his lunch or in his clothes in the suitcase when he travels and items like that. But if you're listening to a man talk and he uses phrases like, you know, that really sounded pretty good
yeah.
to me.
I hear you.
No, I hear you. Oh, okay, you pick up on that.
Uh-huh.
He's auditory. He likes to hear from his wife, boy, you're looking good.
Right.
I really love you. That really means a lot to me.
That
or a phone call during the day.
She can give sweet nothings in his ear
That's
all the time
right.
and keep him smiling. Uh-huh.
But he's also a man who might like music as part of his romance. But he's also a man who might really get bothered easily by too much sound. He might like it very quiet around the home. When he goes out to a restaurant, he might prefer the quiet, hidden type of a restaurant where there's not a lot of hustle and bustle and intense noise. He might be the kind of a man who doesn't want the television or the stereo blaring so much. He might get on the kids because of the sounds that are coming out, and the wife is wondering, well, why does that bother you? Because that's the way he responds to his world. Then you have people who are feeling-oriented. I sense what you're talking about. That really feels good to me. And, you know, a number of phrases like that. When you have somebody who's like that, then you can respond with the same kind of terminology, and they will pick up on it. Now, here is where part of my own journey comes in. I was raised, I think, primarily visual. I read so much as a child. And I've taken in life so much through my eyes. When I'm out walking in the woods, I'm a scanner. I look. I often see things that many other people do not look for because I'm trying to take in as much of life as possible. And I'll notice the different colors and the hues of flowers, and that means a great deal to me. But over the years, I've worked on and learned how to develop the auditory part where it's almost as strong, and then the feeling has been the late bloomer. This has been probably in the last, since I'm 50 now, probably in the last 20 years that has really developed. And so all of these are a part of my life, which I'm so thankful for, since it gives me a greater depth and dimension in my life. I can experience things to a greater degree, and it also helps me in my conversations with other people. For example, in my counseling, when somebody comes in and they start using visual words.
Right. You can
then
switch.
Then I can switch and I will start using that terminology. If it's hearing words, I can use that. If it's the kinesthetic or the feeling words, I can use that. I'm also tied into watching eye movements because you can tell by the direction that a person looks with their eyes whether they are formulating or recalling an image or formulating or recalling a conversation or whether they're experiencing a feeling by the way in which they look down to the ground. And it's fascinating to see how that works in counseling, because if somebody, you know, is looking up with their eyes, I might say, you know, I'm just wondering if you're trying to recall that experience that you went through and see what was occurring. And they'll say, oh, yeah, how did you know that? Well, you know, lucky guess or so.
Right. And I'm thinking, as a mother sitting here, I'm thinking, this is tremendously important for your different children. And,
Yes. You
know, how the kinds of things they need in their environment, depending on the type of...
There's two things that come to mind as a parent. It's observing the children at their age now, and they're leaning toward being more visual or auditory or the feeling orientation. But if you notice that one is much more dominant, now is the prime time to really encourage and nurture the other areas that might not be as strong. Now, one of the other things that I would do in counseling, Jan, and I think this illustrates the difference between husbands and wives, I might have a couple that comes in, and I listen to their story, and maybe the man is giving me the story in two or three or four sentences, just sort of the bottom line approach, and I will communicate with him in that way. And then as his wife will talk to me, she will give me quite a bit of rich description with feeling and emotional words, and maybe go around the topic two or three times and come back to it, and I feel comfortable in talking with her in the same way, and maybe halfway through the session I will say, John, are you and I communicating? Are we hitting the point together? He'll say, oh, yeah, we really are. And I'll turn to Janice and say, Janice, am I really sensing what it is that you're sharing with me? Are we really on the same track together? And she'll say, yeah, we really are. And then often I will look at them and say, I've met the two of you a half hour ago. We're communicating. The two of you have been married for 15 years. You say you're not communicating. What's the difference?
Uh-huh.
And I will keep posing that and posing it until they're just really scratching their heads. And then I know that they will be able to hear what I say as I describe what I've been doing, and now encourage them to begin using one another's language, and also encourage them in the fact that as you begin to learn this foreign language, if you took foreign language in high school or in college, you realized that it takes a long time to perfect it. In fact, it probably takes you many years before you begin to think in the foreign language, let alone speak it. So it's going to be the same way here. It's going to take work and concentration. And so when you talk with one another, I would suggest to the husband, when you talk to your wife, amplify.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk to his wife, I would say, when you talk to your husband now, condense.
Right.
I mentioned the word fine a few times in this conversation
already.
You
sure did.
And it's one of the most common comments that I hear coming from men. And often, a wife is so confused by, what does fine mean? And so when I have a man in counseling give a response of fine to his wife, I will say, well, George, on a scale of 0 to 10,
right,
what does fine mean? And often he will say, that's an 8.
And she'll
and
be
she
shocked.
Will look shocked. She'll
right.
Say, you could have fooled me.
Right.
I never knew
she
that.
Thought it was a minus 3.
I saw a couple last week. And we spent, I guess, about 30 minutes dealing with this one issue of speaking one another's language. And when they went out, they said, from this point on, whenever the word fine comes up, we will ask for the scale of 0
Love
to 10.
Love it. That's great.
And then when they walked out, I said to the man, does that sound all right to you? And he looked at me and grinned and said, fine.
That's great. All right. I want to know, because you get into the area of sex, and I want to know, how can the performance trap and workaholism affect a man's sex life? And then, if it really does affect my husband's sex life, and perhaps my husband is struggling with impotence, is there anything that I as a woman can do?
Well, you went right to the loaded question,
didn't
you, Jane?
I went right to the loaded question. This is a very real one. I keep running into women with this is a big, big issue.
And I keep running into men who are struggling with a problem. And what's unfortunate is that they have struggled with it so long, and they've tried to deal with it themselves, and they've been embarrassed or hesitant to share this with somebody else, that it just reinforces the difficulty. Now, unfortunately, many men view sex as part of the performance ethic, that I've really got to be top here. I've really got to do a good job. And
after another badge for Boy Scouts.
That's right. That's the way they see it. And they pride themselves in their performance. And what they don't realize, though, is that the physical act of sex for a woman is not the physical act of sex. A few years ago, there was a book written that people laughed about the title, but I think the title is so true. It was a title that said, Sex Begins in the Kitchen. And the tenderness, the conversation, that occurs between a man and a woman all through the day leads up to that sexual experience. And some men use sex as their release from stress, which makes it more of an experience just for themselves instead of looking to fulfill the needs of the woman. And I have found many, many couples where they've never really openly talked about sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really encourage the wives to, you know, make a whole list of non-threatening questions about sexuality and begin with those and say, you know, honey, I've got a list of about 15 questions here on sex, but I only want to ask you two of them tonight. How does that sound?
Mm-hmm.
And then ask the two and say, thank you, that's interesting. You know, I guess I really didn't know that was your perspective before, and another time I'll come back to the other questions. Well, the chances are he's not going to let her get out of the room.
Right,
because he wants to know, well, what are those other questions?
Uh-huh.
This is a good topic.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, he's probably hoping that after we talk about this, then maybe we can experience it.
You've already got him thinking. All right.
That's right.
Of course he was thinking beforehand anyway. All right.
But that's one way to move into it and to talk about what sex means, because there are times where it is a release. There's a time where it's a real sense of romance to the man. There are other times where it might even be habit. Now, when you have men who get into the workaholism trap and they're dealing with tremendous stress and pressure, this begins to affect them in many ways. Blood pressure, sleeping, and then maybe because of physical exhaustion, something happens to the body and they're not able to perform. Now, this is not usually a physical problem per se, because the main sexual organ is the brain. And sometimes our brains become overloaded. And if a man begins to experience any kind of impotency, whether it's not being able to get an erection, or he isn't able to ejaculate, or he fails halfway through the experience, his whole concept is, all right, next time we'll try harder. And he will put more pressure on himself, and consciously and unconsciously he will be thinking, boy, I've got to make it this time. I've got to perform. I've really got to succeed. And that becomes the vicious cycle. That
right.
is a trap. And so he goes to approach his wife, and all of a sudden, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he feels worse about it, but he doesn't verbalize how he feels. And he keeps it inward and just bears down even more, and I've got to succeed. And now he's on this rotation where nothing is happening, and pretty soon
he doesn't want it
at all. He's not going to approach his wife, and she begins to wonder, am I the cause
right.
of it? Did I do something wrong? Am I unattractive? And in some men's minds, they will begin thinking, well, it's her problem. She's not
mm-hmm.
attractive. She's 10 pounds overweight. You know, somebody else really would turn me on. They might move into pornography. They might begin viewing adult films. They might go out on the side to try to prove that it's the other person and not themselves.
What can an understanding wife do, though, if she, you know, if there are a couple of times?
Listen to him. Encourage him. Let him know that this is perfectly all right with her. She's not going to take it as a personal rejection. She doesn't see it as a defect in him. And the best thing would be just to rest, and if you feel like making contact another time, that's okay. Now, usually what occurs is that as couples come in or one person comes in, we try to take the pressure off by giving them a, I guess you'd call it a program where, you know, for the next few days, I just want you to hug and kiss. That's
right.
all you have to do.
Right.
And then after that, you can go a little further, and if you happen to have an erection, you don't have to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's progressively. Pretty soon they're building up and building up, and, you know, many times they'll come in and say, well, you know, I hate to tell you, Norm, but I broke your rules, you know, two or three times this last week because it happened and things are going so well, and, you know, it's really worked out. And then we talked about, now, why did that happen? What will you do the next time this occurs? Because for all of us, including myself, we will go through several times of impotency in our life because of stress or exhaustion and pressure. And if we can realize when it occurs, okay, they said this might occur, it's normal, sure, I can go to the doctor, but he'll probably say it's stress and relax. And so if a man would purposely back off and just, you know, sit in the living room and just hug and kiss for 10 or 15 minutes, and there's no specific purpose in terms of we have to go to
right.
bed, just enjoy one another. In fact,
the woman will eat this up because the woman doesn't like to feel that every time she's touched, it's instantly into bed.
That's right. And maybe think of, you know, what you used to do when you were dating. You'd sit out in the car, sit out in the parlor, and just, you know, hug and kiss for a while and take it slow, and you don't have to perform. That's maybe the message that many men have to hear or need to hear, mm-hmm. that you don't have to perform as such.
I think that's terribly, terribly important. Through this entire book, I get the feeling from a woman's perspective that I have to be responsible for my own feelings and my own growth and my own everything. I cannot take responsibility for my husband. And I like that.
But many women do take the responsibility.
Right.
And sometimes that responsibility comes across as control. And the man does not like to be controlled. In fact, in our chapter in the book on stress, mm-hmm. one of the biggest issues that we talked about that is the biggest stressor for men is feeling out of control. And I'm not talking about just major issues. It's the subtle, small issues. Men don't like waiting in line at a restaurant. If the maitre d' says, well, you'll have to wait for 20 minutes, often you will hear a man say, let's go elsewhere. We don't have to wait here. Well, that's simply to regain his sense of control. That's why so many men do not feel comfortable riding in the passenger side of the car. It's because they're not behind the wheel and they're out of control.
Or when the wife starts back to work, even if he's decided that it's a good thing for her to do.
Yes, and especially if this means now he is going to have to help out in the home with some of the areas that he's never had to help with before, or if she starts making more money.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes threatening to him. And what I like to suggest to women there is don't quit because you're making more money. Don't back off because you're gifted, because the other person is intimidated. We'd like the other person to come to the point where they would accept the fact that both of you are gifted. And at times one will make more than the other, and just accept that and enjoy it.
Right. Enjoy. In this whole area, you mention about a woman who might be married to a child man and how her tendency is to take control and mother. And that's the worst thing she could do.
I've worked with a number of couples where, unfortunately, the man, for some reason, and usually it's tied into his own relationship with his mother, but he never really fully grew up. And as he was dating, he was drawn to a woman who was capable, who might have responded in some similar ways as his mother did. And so the marriage occurred, and he just went from one nest to the other. And after a number of years, the women who are married to men like this become quite dissatisfied, angry, disenchanted.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And they're wondering, what in the world do I do? And often they continue to fill in the gaps that the man leaves. They pick up after him. They respond to him as a mother would. And the best thing to do is to back off and not behave in that same way. One of the statements that I have been asking people for years is the question, if what you're doing in a relationship isn't working, why keep on doing it? There's got to be a better way. Now, in that chapter, we're talking about some concepts that came from the Peter Pan syndrome.
Right.
And if there's any woman who has a husband or a man in their life that responds as a child, or is a man who has tremendous anger and is degrading to them as a person, they ought to go back to the original sources that I used in that particular chapter. And there's a couple of different books there.
Right.
And read those in their complete form, because it might help them identify why they are having some difficulty in their life. Now, one of the things that we were trying to stress in all of this, Jan, is that men and women are different. That isn't the problem. The problem is seeing their differentness as something that is weird, something that shouldn't be.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know of anybody that wants to be married or tied into a person who's a clone of themselves. We want to learn to take these differences and use them in a complementary type of a relationship. God created women the way they are, and he created men the way they are. Now, we have taken some of those differences and sometimes gone to the extreme with some of our characteristics, and those ought to be modified. But if we can be sensitive to, this is the way a woman is, this is the way a man is, and if they're this way, instead of fighting it head on, maybe it would be better to accept it, go with it, and then make some gradual changes, such as the ones we've talked about on modifying our communication. I have had to learn, and I don't see it as a chore, it's really helped me, but I've needed to learn how to express information to my wife, Joyce, in a way that meets all her receptors and really expresses it the way that she wants to hear it. My wife is one who likes to hear quite a bit of detail, and she prefers to have one topic presented at a time, whereas I tend to jump around to topics because I can handle three or four different topics at one time. And this is where she and I are quite different from the general, population sample, where women are the ones who are better able to handle three or four things at one time, and men are usually single-minded. I have to laugh at the situation that I have heard hundreds of times where a husband will hear about their friends having a baby, and he will come home and share with his wife that, hey, so-and-so today, they had their baby. And she will say, oh, what was it, a boy or a girl? What's the name? How long? Well, how many pounds? And he'll say, I don't know. You know, a kid is a kid.
Right.
Well,
right.
I have done that myself.
Uh-huh.
But recently, when our good friends had their first grandchild, I grilled my friend. I said, okay, Don, the baby's name, all three names, length, weight, length of labor, when they're going home. And I went home and I said to Joyce, honey, Don and Billy had their first grandchild today, and I wanted to tell you about it. The name of the baby is such and such. It was 8 pounds, 11 ounces, 21 inches long. It was a 24-hour labor. They're doing fine. They're going to go home in a day and a half, and that's about all I can remember. And I walked on, and she just sort of stood there stunned. But
that's
this is what
great.
She wanted.
That is wonderful. I love this because I see, as I read this, I felt very much as if what's happening that is destructive is that we as women are deciding that, well, we're just going to become more masculine. And so, you know, because some of those characteristics that you were describing as specifically masculine are ones that many women are trying to emulate.
That's true.
Now.
That's really true.
And I love that, appreciating both facets and making the most of it.
You know, one of the things that we've discovered, Jan, about the book is that it was written primarily for women. But we are finding more and more men who are starting to read the book. Maybe they take the cover off so that nobody can see that they're reading it. But I would encourage women, if they are reading it, to every now and then just read a statement out loud to their husband or to the important man in their life and say, listen to this. What do you think about this?
Mm-hmm.
Not ask, how do you feel about it, unless that's his terminology, but
right.
say, what do you think about this? Is this, you know, the way you experience
I
things?
I had a fascinating discussion with our son, who's almost 12. And I took the section on the different kinds of fathers. And I said, Chris, listen to this. What do you think? You know, have you seen some dads like this, et cetera? And then your description of the characteristics that a real well-rounded father needs to have. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, Dad's not doing too badly, is he?
That's
but it
great.
Was really precious. Oh. You know, and even worked with a boy child, I would still call him. You know, he's moving into those teenage years.
Mm.
But, yeah.
I'm glad you suggested that because I was thinking mainly in terms of wives and husbands, but to start using this with your own children would be another avenue.
Oh, it was very precious because it was an adult conversation that was, you know, happening with this person who wasn't yet quite an adult. But it was wonderful.
Mm.
Yeah.
Jan, I really appreciate the questions you've been asking me during this interview. And since we're coming down to just about the end of it, I was wondering if there was another question or so that you wanted to throw at me before we conclude.
Well, you said that one of the most important goals for a man, and I would also say a woman, is going for balance.
That's right.
And I'd just like you to amplify that a little, if you can.
In terms of balance for a man, since so many men see work as their avenue of expression and source of identity, unfortunately, they go through life missing out on some other elements that are so important to them. And let me just share some things that have happened with me along this line. Because of having a retarded child, my perspective on little things in life has become much different. For example, we take so much in life for granted. It was just about, I'd say, 2 months ago when I was bringing my son home for a visit for the day. And just to give a further explanation, our son Matthew at this point is 20, but mentally he's about 16 months old. And so he has maybe 8 to 10 words that he says now and then, and I don't know how much meaning there is. But as we were driving home, I talked to Matthew and I kid with him, even though there's not much response. And all of a sudden I heard the words, "Matthew." And I turn and I look, "Matthew, what did you say?" And he said, "Matthew." And about 5 or 6 times that day, Joyce and I heard the words, "Matthew." Now, you know, when you wait 20 years to hear something like that, it's so small, it could be lost in its insignificance. And yet, that is something I will probably never forget. That had tremendous meaning for me to hear my son mention his own
his own name
for the first
time. His own identity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something else along this line, over the past year, I've had a few physical problems that have cropped up where for a period of time I wasn't certain what was wrong or what was going on, and there were no answers. And I did not like what I felt, what I experienced, what I went through, but now as I'm coming out of it some, I look back and I wouldn't trade this experience for anything because it gave me a greater balance. It's caused me to evaluate, again, how do I use my time? What's really important? It's caused me to spend more time with friends and family and to get away from work, because I've struggled with the work issue over the years. There was a strong emphasis on performance as I was being raised, and I've always loved and enjoyed whatever I have done. And so sometimes I have overdone, and I've had to really work at this. But to be able to reflect over this past year on those items which are so significant, I think has brought a much better balance into my life. And as I was praying the other night, one of the statements that I made in my prayer to the Lord was, "Lord, help me not to ever forget the lessons that I have learned during this time, nor lose what I have learned." And sometimes it's so easy for us as men to do that.
From Word Publishing, you've been listening to Jan Kongo interview Dr. Norman Wright about how to understand the man in your life. This how-to library presentation has been based on Dr. Wright's book titled Understanding the Man in Your Life, published by Word Books, copyright 1987. If this discussion has piqued your interest in this subject, then we encourage you to obtain a copy of the book, available at bookstores nationwide. Included in the book are helpful questionnaires and self-tests to help women to sort out their opinions and feelings about men. In addition, there is also a study guide for group or personal use. The book title again is Understanding the Man in Your Life, and it's by Dr. H. Norman Wright. And while visiting your local bookstore, be sure to look for other titles available in the How-To Library series. Some of the practical how-to titles you will find include How to Become the Best Version of You by Tim Hansel, How to Find Sexual Harmony in Marriage by Ray and Ann Ortland, How to Reconcile a Marriage by James Dobson, How to Help Your Child Say No to Sexual Pressure by Josh McDowell, How to Understand Yourself and Others by Florence Littauer, and How to Overcome Depression by Drs. Frank Minerth and Paul Meyer. Other resources available from Word Publishing include book tracks, books on cassettes, Life Lifters featuring inspiring messages on single cassettes, 6, 8, and 12 cassette albums, as well as best-selling books, video curriculum resources, single videos, and films. To learn more about the multitude of learning resources available from Word Publishing, inquire at your local Christian bookstore or write to Word Incorporated, Educational Products Division, Post Office Box 2518, Waco, Texas, 76702-2518. The Word Audio How-To Library is produced by the Publishing Division of Word Incorporated, the leader in Christian audio cassette resources, bringing the Word to life.